Yes, you should. Today is Saturday, February 21st, 2009. This is LTUE, What Every Writer Should Know About Archaeology. Question. Well, first, I don't know how much, just considering what people write about ancient cultures and fantasy and science fiction, what are some of the big mistakes that they make that you've seen? Like the really annoying ones that stand out to you.
Well, Charlotte probably shares one of my annoyances. I don't know that it's an annoying one to me. It's just kind of funny that it keeps coming up. It has to do with the Celts and Stonehenge. That's one of the areas that is right across the border from Stonehenge, and I focus on the Celts quite a bit. The Druids had nothing to do with Stonehenge, other than possibly using it as an ancient landscape for themselves. It was built thousands of years before the Druids were ever in existence. So I think that's one of the mistakes I see most often, is this kind of acceptance that, oh yes, they built this thing, and nobody realizes the dates are completely wrong. That's one of them.
Yeah. Probably on a broader sense of that question is the fact that most writers, and I include myself in this, if they're not really interested in something, they're not going to do a lot of research, even if they don't include it in their books. So they're going to go look on Wikipedia, and which is much better than it used to be, but still, I mean, they did not dust the statues of Sekhmet in Egypt with Ambrose, which is what was lately claimed on Wikipedia. So, I mean, there's a severe lack of fact-checking on facts. So you just have a writer just throwing something out there like it's fantasy. And it's fine if you're writing a fantasy and you say, look, I'm writing a fantasy in your foreword. You know, this is not necessarily true. This is, like, take whatever I want, stuck it all together. But, making a claim, especially with a historical fantasy, that's totally just absolutely not even close to reality. That's probably the first thing. Yeah.
You made me curious. Do we know anything about people who did build Stonehenge?
Yeah. Stonehenge was started in the Neolithic period, so they're really early farmers of Europe, living in small communities, farming the landscape with the basic crops that came along in the early Neolithic, wheat and barley, and raising cattle and sheep. And they most likely would come together during certain times of the year and build monuments. And the first phases of Stonehenge is actually a monument that's built in multiple phases. The first phase is wood-based monument. And then it kind of got elaborated over time. And as you move into the Bronze Age and people are starting to use metal tools, you get some of the last stages of its construction, which is what you see in the landscape today. So for the most part, they're very basic farmers. That have some pretty interesting religious beliefs from what little we know of their religious beliefs. They bury their dead in big monuments all together for a long period of time. like that to be a burial.
Stonehenge
is not a burial monument itself, no, but it is surrounded by burial monuments in landscape. Yet, one of the things I think a lot of people make a mistake of doing is taking Stonehenge completely out of its landscape. The whole of Salisbury Plain, which is now unfortunately seen as a bombing range, practice range for the RAF, almost the whole of it has ritual elements to it, so lots of burial mounds and things like that. Not a lot of settlements that we've found there yet, but we're still
there. So you may not know, the stone for Stonehenge was actually dragged from the Preseli Hills in southern Wales. Very, very, very long way. So it's pretty important.
They tried to actually do an experiment with that for a Millennium Project. They got money from the British government to build a raft, bring a stone down from the Preseli Mountains, put it on a raft in, what's the name of the Welsh town there?
Welsh is a festival of vowels to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. They put it on the raft to test out this idea that the stones were taken around the coastline and it properly sank. Properly sank into the bay there. So it's still there, as far as we know. But they did take them a very long way. So it would have taken a lot of people, more than just a village. So that's kind of some of the details that we know.
Is it possible Stonehenge might have been intended as a burial site for someone really important?
Possible, but we have other monuments like it in terms of the henge type thing. They're not quite as elaborate as Stonehenge. Some of them are bigger than Stonehenge in terms of sheer size, but none of them tend to have burials inside them that we've ever found. They're all outside, but they're very close by.
Yeah. Here's another question. I mean, unless there's another one. But
let's get that one.
Okay, well, I was gonna ask, what is your opinion on taking historical myth and then imposing that on top of archaeological texts? For example, King Arthur, since you guys are in the British area.
I think it's a lot of fun. Actually, personally, I think it's great fun. The only problem is that I'm a big fan of prefacing whatever you're doing with a statement of what you're doing, because I know a lot of credulous readers who are not going to bother to. I'm a big fan of making sure that you're disseminating fact rather than a falsehood. There's a difference between fiction and falsehood. So if you want to take a site and interpret it how you want to and write a book about it or whatever, I think it's great. It's an exercise in fantasy. It's also, you're doing research on site, which is always good to your own knowledge. I just feel like you want to make sure that you're stating what you're doing ahead of time. So that's my opinion on that.
I can more speak to it as a reader. I'm not a writer, per se, of fiction, but as a reader of fiction and an archaeologist, I often approach books like that and hope that there's a historical note at the end that kind of establishes this is where I'm taking this from. And I'm willing to embrace, the changes and the fun and the fiction of it, because I think that's part of archaeology as well, in terms of a broad overview of what archaeologists do. We are part scientists and part storytellers in a lot of ways. So we get the facts and the bare bones of the thing, and then we need to flesh it out as well to make it enjoyable. And so I think there's that element to it, so it's not that far off from what we're doing. But I like to see fiction writers often be more along our lines. Does that make sense?
Self-American archaeology, things as seen from the air, we've seen so much in documentaries and so forth. Can you comment on those with respect to science fiction writing? I mean, it appears that there's been some strange thing happen here upon this earth, where people make so precisely things seen from the air. So,
yes. The Nazca lines are what you're referring to.
The big spiders and the long roadways, big spiders, yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the Nazca line. I've never actually read a piece of fiction that involved them to any extent. I've read about them. And they're just as much of an enigma to us as archaeologists, I think, as anything, as they are to anybody else. So in terms of creating the story around those, that there's certainly some meat there that you can, as a writer, play with.
And you're going to get less nailed by researchers because they're just as clueless as anybody else. So
they are certainly quite extraordinary, though, in terms of, you know, we accept that they're really only viewable to see the pattern from high up. So how we explain that is you know, as much of a mystery. Most common explanations for the phenomenon are that they are intending these to be seen by the gods or someone above them. Yeah, so that they do have some kind of religious element to them.
Do you have any thoughts on basing archaeology on other planets? I say that because you just said this is your first time doing panels in a SF con.
Basing them on other planets, what do you mean by that?
Finding ruins on another planet.
Oh, okay. So Seta. It's that kind of element. I know a little bit about Seta. For those who might not know what that is, it's the search for extraterrestrial artifacts. It kind of mirrors SETI, which is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I find that a fascinating possibility. It's kind of, if you want to go with the Star Trek, it is the final frontier for archaeologists as well, in terms of what's out there. The viewpoint that I've always taken to it is possibly not so much we're looking for extraterrestrial life and intelligence, more that we as a human race are creating the archaeology of tomorrow. As we are exploring space, we're leaving things out there. Archaeology has often been described as the science of rubbish, and we're certainly leaving a lot of rubbish behind.
I thought of that mittens in the sky. Oh my gosh!
So you know, finding that as the archaeology of the future is an interesting prospect to me. That because archaeologists by nature are interested in all forms of human behavior and what we leave behind in the process of that behavior. So I find that really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just a question. Maybe this is something you do for fun. I've got a friend who's an archaeologist. You might know Katie Richards, but she was telling me sometimes what you guys do for fun is you think, what is our society going to look like 1,000 years, 10,000 years from now, maybe 1,000,000 years from now? What ruins are we going to leave behind? And what if there were like an apocalypse event and like our major cities were abandoned? And what would the archaeologists thousands of years in the future find of us?
I've always thought they'd be very, very confused by Las Vegas.
It must be the gods. It's a holy city to the gods.
It's a holy city to the gods. Well, it's just so much there, and it's not a very natural city, if that makes sense. It's in a landscape where it shouldn't be. We pump a lot of water there. And they might see this as the ultimate city in terms of how archaeologists can explain the taking the time and the labor to bring water to a place, you know, people like the Roman Empire and the aqueducts they built, we see that as quite a grand thing, you know, the time investment, labor investment cost, all of those things. So if you look at Las Vegas that way, they might see that as the premier city of the United States, but that was our capital. We obviously invested quite a lot in that place.
Yeah, you've got ancient cities are showing reflections of all these structures that are in one place in Las Vegas, and you've got one in all these various cities around the world, so obviously they're taking it from the central place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, some of those interpretations are going to be kind of interesting. There was a great book when I was a kid that was written that some of you might be familiar with called Motel of Mysteries.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the kind of game that we do play of what might we find in the future. So things like that I think, oh, we're just really, you know, bucking up stuff for the future.
My husband had an insight about Greek mythology and, you know, the few texts we actually have of it, of the minimal texts that came out. He said, our society will be tomorrow, and archaeologists found, you know, a handful of books. What would they find? Harry Potter novel, Daniel Steele, and, you know, probably, you know, Tom Clancy or Dan Brown or something. We find the stuff that's really popular, most likely, not the stuff that's necessarily good.
We get rid of the really bad stuff, the literary fiction. That's what we get rid of.
Do I have an archaeological view on
Charlotte apparently does. I'm getting shut up to work. Not usually Utah district, but anywhere.
The problem with this, and I mean, this is a problem with when you're considering anything from burying nuclear waste to building new cities to anything that's utilizing land that has been used in the past. Aside from the fact that nuclear waste can get a lot of noise, especially when, you know, I'm out excavating and there's an undocumented dump site and you're close to it and it's contaminated.
Are there undocumented nuclear waste sites?
We hope not. We really hope not.
But how long will the documentation last?
That's another question. I mean, nuclear technology hasn't been around long enough that, you know, we're going to necessarily have a severe fragmentation of documents. But, and talking about that in a broader sense, too, is we have to use the land. I mean, we're here. We got to live. We've got to utilize the landscape. Whether or not we're using it responsibly is a whole other political issue that I'm not even going to bring on. But personally, I'd rather they didn't bury the nuclear waste out there, but I mean, they're going to get out. But I just have to dig out there, so I don't want them to do it.
I have a question. The book I'm writing isn't science fiction fantasy, so I hope this is relevant, but I need to do research from like 6,000 years ago out of Indian times, and how, like, the general world and what's going to be out there isn't going to be thinking of like what it was like as Adam and Eve, as much as it's going to be like half ape, half human civilization. Like, how would you suggest I research that?
That's going to be hard because the science tells us different things than what, I mean, the traditional Christian belief of a 7,000-year-old world with Adam and Eve is not matched by science. I mean, we have bones that are already dated of 64 million years old. I mean, there are things going on with literal interpretation of scripture and science that are not matching up. I mean, all that, of course, that's all about finding a balance between your own faith and your own scientific, you know, setting. But for that kind of research, I don't think you're going to be able to go to the archaeological records. You're going to have to go to more scriptural interpretations and things like that in order to try and build a world out of that. That's at least how I feel about it.
If you wanted to go to the archaeology, you know, you would want to be looking at for dates back 7 million years ago and beyond that to get to kind of Australian scenes and things like that. If you wanted to base it on science. That's when they're talking about, you know, the pre-human or ape-like species, like that. So, yeah. So if you wanted to bring in some of that science, even if it doesn't quite match up, you know, just to get a sense of some details, that's where I would head to.
Yeah. If I were going to do any kind of quick and dirty research, what would be some good internet sites?
About.com is archaeology.
Yeah, what
is it? About.com has an archaeology base that's pretty reliable.
Okay.
It's kind of bare bones and some stuff, but they can at least direct you. And also, as much as Wikipedia drives me crazy, they've started having bibliography of their sources. Excellent.
Their bibliographies are great for linking you into other things and other places.
That's awesome. Thank you. Yeah.
How reliable do you think like the dating techniques we use today are?
It depends on the dating technique that you're talking about. Radiocarbon dating is has been kind of verified in terms of using the scientific method by lots of chemistry labs to be really very accurate for what it is. It always gives you a range of dates in terms of probability. It never actually pinpoints a year for you. So radiocarbon dating before about 50,000 years ago, it's pretty reliable. 20,000 years onward up to, you know, modern times, you're getting really good results with that. Further back than that, as the half-life of the atoms breaks down and the elements break down, you're going to get more and more variation. You're going to have wider spans of time to cover what the probability is. So that's, you know, in terms of verifying that scientifically, they're really pretty good. And the system that they use is really pretty good. And it's been cross-checked with dendrochronology, which is tree ring dating, which we have an extremely accurate tree, puts on a ring a year, you know, we can count back. And having taken samples in places like the Southwest, we now have a tree ring sequence that goes back about 10,000 years. So we've double checked it, and then you can take those each tree ring sample, date that radiocarbon with radiocarbon dating, and cross check the date. So up to 10,000 years ago, spot on. If you're going back to other kinds of dating, like potassium argon and uranium series, which are some of the things that are used to date fossils and volcanic stone and things like that, you're dealing with a different type of science, to some extent. So, you know, very. But radiocarbon dating is probably the most common one.
Well, are the others less expensive? Is that why you're doing them? Or
no.
why are they experimenting?
They deal with something different. But potassium argon and uranium series dating tends to be more applicable to things beyond 50,000 years ago when radiocarbon dating doesn't really work.
Oh.
Or it's dating volcanic eruptions within which you find fossils of things like osteopithecines and Homo erectus and those kinds of things. So it's dealing with stuff that's a little bit older, where radiocarbon dating just doesn't touch. Longer half-life, yeah. I think potassium argon is like 1.8 years or something like that. It's really quite large.
Are there any new and up-and-coming methods that, like, somebody who had 10 or 15 years ago would not know about?
Upcoming methods of just in archaeology in general?
Well, of dating. Of
dating.
Okay, when you're writing for a science fiction novel, it's like they're not going to be using the same techniques in the future as they are now.
Although, interestingly, it was pointed out to me that in Star Trek, which is supposed to be in the future, archaeologists, you know, in the next generation, what's the button? So I'm archaeologist, Captain Picard. Thank you, Captain Picard. I'm so really bad at sci-fi topics, not knowing that. That, you know, he was an archaeologist, but every archaeological scene that I've ever seen in the person that told me this was talking about, he was still using a shovel. And that was it. And I was like, really? The tools haven't moved on at all? And so often in fiction, you don't see that. So I'm glad you're thinking of it, because the stereotype is always shovel.
That's why I have a degree in, you know, just a bachelor's in archaeology, and I like to write science fiction. So I'm always trying to kind of keep up. But like I say, it's kind of an old degree. So.
In terms of dating, the radiocarbon dating is basically just becoming refined and better. And we're using AMS dating now more than anything, which is allowing smaller samples to be taken, and it's less destructive. Excavation-wise, we're using a lot more geophysical survey. We're constantly looking right now for techniques that are less destructive. Because archaeology by its nature is a destructive kind of thing. You only dig a site once, twice if you're really a masochist. And you really want to spend time digging and not finding anything. What I did this last summer was re-excavate a site, so had that experience. So if we can see what's under the ground without actually disturbing it first, and we can refine where we're going to excavate, that really is what we like. And some of the techniques that they're trying to play with now are actually taking snapshots of things at different levels under the ground to get kind of a stratigraphy without ever actually having to dig. So technologies like that are probably the most up-and-coming ones right now.
But you still, does it, when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, are you still down there with the problem?
Yeah, at some point you are going to have to get on your knees and dig. I mean, all of the surveys give us a lot of information, but there's still information that you can only get by actually having the artifacts, the items, mm-hmm. and knowing where they came from. So there's always going to be an element of digging in it, but the more focused we can be with where we dig, the less destruction we do. Yeah.
I know one of the things you do with archaeology is trace the way human beings have changed physiologically. Mm-hmm. The line between archaeology and studying dinosaurs, what's the word for that? Paleontology, sorry.
Paleontology.
You know, it's very, it can get kind of blurred, but what do you think human beings are going to, you know, if they continue to evolve the way they're doing, what do you think they're going to look like 10,000 or maybe like a million or 10 million years in the future?
Well, if they're related to me, they're going to get shorter and shorter, apparently. I am the smallest member of my family, apart from my mother. I don't know. I'm just the smallest, period. What are they going to be like? That's an interesting
I remember seeing a photo on the cover of Time magazine about what would it would look like if all the races blended together at some point in the future. We would have like a kind of a brown skin, black hair, the entire species on Earth.
All become similar looking? Yeah, possibility.
I don't know if there's even a way you can postulate any kind of projection. I mean, if you take a look at all the skulls back from, you know, Australopithecus all the way up to a modern skull, and you include all the different races and all the different variation that we find, there's, I don't think there's any predictability in the pattern, personally, at least I've not ever seen one. So I mean, that's an excellent question. You know, we could all could end up somehow with tall foreheads and elongated jaws, or, you know, I mean, and there's a certain amount of structure changing to adapt to an environment. There are a lot of variables. There's a lot of variables. I don't see that there's any way that we can even begin to guess.
Well, that one that raises really even it is almost artificial. Well, not almost. It's pretty much an artificial construct in society. There really isn't a lot of difference between two people who look completely different.
Well, at least definitely the bone structure
level. A lot of the racial studies that were done in anthropology, physical kind of studies, that were done at the turn of the 20th century, kind of the early 1900s, those have really been abandoned by anthropology, so they're not really following those lines of inquiry anymore, because they kind of realized that what they were doing was really more politically and socially motivated than anything else.
It's a good example of bad research. So.
Is there kind of a legality to finding artifacts, treasure? I mean, where does it go?
It depends on where you are. Mm-hmm. So, as authors, you know, depending on where your story is set. Mm-hmm. There are international laws, and then there are EU laws, and there are national laws here. Depends on where you are. If it's private property, in a lot of places, often it's up to the property owner.
It was the rights to stay with the owner if it's
mostly. Depends on what it is. There are certain value levels. If it's a kind of a hoard of coins or something like that that has a value level because of gold, the federal governments often come in and claim part of it or take it.
I do know that in Egypt, a rule has been applied for the last who knows how long, that all Egyptian artifacts found must stay within Egypt.
And that's a change from the colonial kind of period when it's been enacted by our lovely friend Zaki Fawaz, who shows up in every Egyptology special you'll ever see, the guy with the Indiana Jones hat. Which we can talk about stereotypes if you want, wardrobe-wise. It's really a reaction against what happened in the early 20th century, early 1900s, in that if you found something by law, you got to keep part of it, usually about a third of it. And so, like, Lord Carnarvon's estate in England has part of the King Tut treasures, and they own them, and they aren't in Egypt. So there's been a big crusade in Egypt recently to get a lot of the Egyptian stuff back. It's similar to the crusade to get the Parthenon marbles, or the Elgin marbles, as some people call it, back to Greece and things like that. But that goes into murky waters of legality and acts of Congress and parliaments and, you know, all those kinds of things, and how they were gotten in the first place. And
their website on that?
The Elgin marbles?
Yeah, just anything.
Good place to start is with the debate over the Elgin marbles. And there's a great one at the British Museum who holds them. They have kind of their site. They have links to the Greek government site, so you can kind of get into that. And that'll probably lead you into some of those other avenues.
Cool.
Yeah. Also, definitely, especially here in the States, if you're working at all with Southwestern archaeology, or actually Native American archaeology anywhere, but especially out at the Southwest, those burials, no matter how old they are, will be claimed by a Native American tribe, one or another, whether or not there's any science to back it up whatsoever. Sorry,
The law is called NAGPRA, NAGPRA. It's called the Native American Grave and Protection and Repatriation Act. So, but if you just Google NAGPRA, you'll find something on that. So if it's one of those two places, that's a good way.
You guys are too young to remember this, but when I was a kid at Temple Square, in the building that's now the one of the visitor centers, there were cases and cases of Indian scarlet.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what happened to those?
My guess is, from what little I know about the church museums and things like that, they fell under the same guidelines everyone did when NAGPRA was enacted, which is to make a report of what you have, publish it, make it public, and then it fell into kind of some of those, anybody who wanted to claim it, you know, came and made their case, and it got heard in court and stuff, but I don't know precisely what happened. That would be my guess.
U-Nation actually reclaimed a lot of those.
Yeah, a lot of them have been reclaimed. A lot of things have been reclaimed from the Museum of Peoples and Cultures here on campus as well. Pretty much under NAGPRA, everybody except the Smithsonian is being. Smithsonian's falls under slightly different guidelines because of the nature of their collections. Everybody's kind of held to that standard over pretty much everybody.
What ancient cultures were known to have like booby traps and curses and stuff?
I've never come across a booby trap other than the strings that I put up. I trip over those all the time.
Isn't there a maze under Saqqara, like the pyramid? The pyramid in Egypt, Saqqara. Isn't it? It's closed to the public because of the mazes, and I heard there are some traps in there.
Yeah, there are some pitfalls and false rooms and things like that in the Egyptian pyramids. That's not inaccurate. They would try and kind of fool people into, you know, not knowing that this is the right way and things like that. Didn't always work. Usually didn't work.
Even those false rooms and false doors and things that a lot of times seem to be original.
Part of the problem is anything with a mechanism involving cords or wood or whatever is going to deteriorate fairly rapidly.
A lot of the evidence is not. So unless it's something like they built a big shaft for somebody to fall down.
That seems to be the
favorite. The favorite, yeah, version of it. That's the kind of thing, though, that survives in the archaeological record. So there might have been other things. It's always fun to watch Indiana Jones run away from the dark and things like that, but not a lot of evidence.
In China, it said that Qin Shi Huangdi's tomb is completely booby-trapped, and that's the reason why the Chinese, one of the reasons why the Chinese refused to go in there.
Now I don't know about that.
I think that's a lot of really old historical propaganda, personally. I think I don't know how much of it is reality, but I think it's also a political defense mechanism to keep people out of Chinese history, personally. So
it's been a
robust. Have any archaeologists died by falling into one of these big pits?
There was an archaeologist who was drawing one of the stones at East Avebury that got crushed by the stone. Yeah. So, you know, it toppled over on them. It wasn't really a booby trap, other than the fact that they undercut it when they were digging and, you know, weakened it, destabilized it, and it fell on it. So.
Well, things happen on site, but it's not nearly so deadly as a profession is, as Hollywood profession makes it.
Oh, I'm sorry, to go back to, like, during war, looting, war times, would there be more legality of returning that also, like, arts, World War II kind of thing?
I don't know. There's,
that's more cultural.
Yeah, as well. During war times, that's a sticky situation as well. You're kind of in there with, you know, returning, like, Jewish works of art and stuff like that were taken. As a lot of the things that I know about that have disappeared during the war, things like the Amber Room in Russia, things haven't been found. And so I think that's why we haven't dealt with it a lot. If they get found, then that would be a great thing. And hopefully we can deal with it. But I don't know that there's a lot that has been found. So I don't have that to get started.
Civil War relics.
What about them?
Like, they're in this country, they belong to.
Again, it depends on where they're found, usually. If it's a war, if it's a battlefield and it's, you know, BLM land or national park land and things like that, they belong to the government. And taking anything from those is a federal offense. Private land, I think you fall, again, underneath the private ownership clause. So, or you have to work with the landowners.
Elaborate on the Amber Room that you just mentioned.
Elaborate on the Amber Room. What little I know of it is it was a room in one of the Russian palaces that was, the walls were made entirely of amber. It was the largest amount of Baltic amber that was in any one place. And and the ceiling and things, and then of course as the Russian gold work and things like that. And it was dismantled as they were trying to try and keep it safe. The room was dismantled, the panels were taken down, the big amber panels, and hidden, and nobody knows what happened to them. There's kind of some conflicting accounts of they came in and they took them, or they were hidden and then the people that hid them died, and nobody knows where they are. And nothing's really ever been found of them. So that's a little bit of history I know on those. But the Baltic amber, you know, is known throughout history, ancient history, as being one of the things people really wanted to get. It was traded all the way back into the Neolithic times, you know, 5,000 BC, well back into those times, down into the Mediterranean. It shows up in Egypt, it shows up in Mesopotamia.
Give us some details as to the amber and its how they found it, where they find it in that part of the country. I know over here where they do.
In terms of the Baltic region,
yeah.
They find it a lot of times on the coastline. It washes up on beaches and things like that, and then it's just in the environment, so they also dig for it. But for whatever reason, the environmental, you know, elements of what it was like there in the Ice Age means that there's a huge amount of it there. So a lot of the amber that you see from those world civilizations, Rome, Greece, Egypt, that's all coming mostly from the Baltic. So huge stores of it. Other than that, I don't know the precise details of where they're finding most of it. But it is still coming out of the Baltic.
So have you heard anything about the old Montezuma thing in southern Utah?
The Montezuma?
Well, Montezuma Canyon is huge, so what specific thing?
I don't know. There's just some, like, kind of legends, kind of stories that were going around in the community I lived. And so I was wondering if you guys knew anything.
I know Montezuma is a site. I mean, it's a massive occupation site. I should know that, and I don't. It was a site of really heavy occupation. A lot of people lived there. There's a lot of subsistence activity going on there, but I don't know of any legends surrounding it. I mean, I've never visited it. I just know it from an academic standpoint, so sorry. Yeah.
I know society, we have like this this view of our archaeology and prehistory going from like the Stone Age then to the, which was like the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, and this, you know, up and like that. Is it always like a clear progression like that, or is there vary it a lot, and why does it vary?
That is a system that was developed. It's one of the earliest dating systems that we had, relative dating. It was developed by a Danish man in a museum, and then they went out and excavated and found that that's mostly true, but it's only really accurate for Europe, and only really works for Europe. Elsewhere, you've got other kinds of things going on, so you've got places like Mesoamerica where they never used metal at all, and when the Spanish arrived, they still had obsidian tools and fairly complex and sophisticated ones, but that's what they were using for battle and weaponry and things like that.
So, and it's even going to vary from area to area in Europe. So, I mean, I'm studying this little tiny period of Iron Age Wales, whereas elsewhere in Europe, there's still so many. I think for an exaggerated example, a little further.
When the Romans show up, the Iron Age stops for a lot of places, or we see archaeologically, you say, oh, the Iron Age is over now for them. Whereas, you know, beyond where the boundaries of the empire were, they just kind of carried on. And so you have the Celts in some places, some people claim up until the 1400s, kind of Celtic culture is still developing and still working and functioning. So
never mind going back to Iron Age, this is after the Romans. Yeah.
But we still have Stone Age cultures in the world today.
Yes. So just, you know, so kind of that general idea that we have of stone, bronze, iron, that's really only Europe, and then the picture gets, if you dig deeper, it gets really complex underneath that.
Well, what happens when a society regresses from, like, being a more higher technology to going backwards to, like, towards the Stone Age or something like that?
One of the questions is there regression? And archaeologists have been trying to deal with that. There are some examples where they've changed their lifestyle. Things like the Fremont here in Utah went back at a certain period back to hunting and gathering as opposed to farming. And so what archaeologists are trying to do often is put together the evidence to understand the story of why that happened and try and come up with explanations. And here in Utah, the most classic explanation, the most accepted one, is that there was a drought. and they were farming already at the kind of edge of where it was applicable, you know, possible to farm. And so you have a slight change in temperature and a slight change in precipitation, and things go downhill very quickly. And so hunting and gathering was the easier lifestyle in some ways, and that, you know, it was more productive for them. They could survive better that way. So it's more of it. Yeah, if we see a change like that, that's often when archaeologists can start to take notice and try and find an explanation. Yeah.
This is kind of maybe a big question, but you mentioned before how archaeologists are part storytellers, and I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts on, or just your experience maybe, in how you go from the material evidence and extrapolate an understanding of the culture to where you can say we're pretty confident about these aspects of their religious beliefs or things like that.
Okay. Do you want me to take this, or do you want to take this?
I've got
it. Okay, well, I'll tell you what I tell my students when I'm working with these kind of things. Archaeologists, the scientist side of an archaeologist always looks at that. How many assumptions am I making, you know, apply Occam's razor, and not make huge leaps in logic. So we try and kind of rein that in, but at the same time we recognize that there are different levels of things that we can get to. So if we're talking about technology, it's pretty easy just to pick up a knife or a sword or something and say, I understand this technology, they're working metal, I can understand metallurgy. We can get to a lot of kind of facts about that. As you move up through different categories of questions, so if you're talking about economics, you can often find the remains of what they were eating, you know, whether they were cooking it, they just scattered it around, or if it's in them still, and you have a person that has that equipment. That gives you fairly good evidence. It's those questions like ritual and religion where you're only going to get a reflection of what they were, and as an archaeologist, you kind of have to accept and be open about, I'm never going to completely get into the mindset of somebody else. From the past, because they're not around to talk to me about it. And that's what ritual and religion is. It's a belief system. And what we're looking at is the expression of those belief systems in the material. And so those are questions where you do often have to have those higher levels of inference. So we try to be logical in that in kind of establishing that human behavior and human nature hasn't changed, really. And so things that would make sense to us are possibilities, and we will kind of pull those out as possibilities and tell the story based on those. Whereas, you know, things that are a little more fantastical, we might be a little more disinclined to go on. Does that make sense in terms of, I'm trying to think of an example. One of the classic ones, you know, is artwork, Ice Age artwork, things like Lascaux, in the caves in Lascaux. Why did they go into the deep, dark element, you know, areas of these caves to paint pictures. You know, it's not beyond the realm of belief that this was some kind of ritual act, that they were going through some kind of ceremony, and this was part of it. That's something that we see people do today still. And we use a lot of ethnography, anthropological studies of what people do today. I think you could probably go a little more fantastical with it, and that's where an archaeologist would go, oh, hold on, you know, you could get into stories of what are some of the great ones that I've heard? Drug-induced comas or trances, and they're dancing around
magicians.
Chanting. Sorry?
Architect magicians?
Oh, that was one that came up in one of my classes, one of my former students. So, you know, applying labels like that where you're just kind of really jumping off what might be decent.
It sort of becomes science fiction.
Then that becomes science fiction. And I embrace science fiction. I don't want to make it sound like don't, but in terms of it on an academic level.
Well, you know most of what I was going to say, but it's a really, really tricky thing because a lot of people fall into either two categories of either overinterpretation or just description without interpretation, and both of them are hugely problematic. But as Jamie said, the problem is that we really are never really going to know, and while you can assume that human nature hasn't really changed, there's nothing to say that there really wasn't something completely wacky going on or that there wasn't anything going on. I mean, if you look at one of our modern rooms, take like my living room with TV set. Anybody coming along who didn't have an understanding of our technology necessarily would think that this object was something ritual because everything in the room was centered on it. You know, all the chairs face it, everything is centered on this thing that we just use. It's part of what we do. And so there's this problem of understanding really the context and what's actually going on, and there's absolutely no way to see it. Ethnography is a double-edged sword because it can be really, really good, but it can also lead you completely a totally a straight take. You have the platform mount building systems in the Southwest, where you have these huge mounts that are being constructed, like masonry laid down, the earthworks put in, and we're not really sure what they reported, but structures on top of them are usually built in the older architectural style than we're seeing as contemporaneous living quarters. There's sometimes burials, there's sometimes not, there's some evidence that people live in there, some not. And so the only thing that we've been able to do is go out and take do ethnographic research on other cultures in completely different parts of the world that build similar mounts, and try and take all the things that are in common with all of those six or seven ethnographies and try and maybe see if some of that was going on in the Southwest. So it's just, it's a really, really sticky business.
I think a good archaeologist will always, is willing to go there in terms of, I'll make some possibilities available to the reader. But at the same time, they acknowledge that these are only a data, possibilities, and they kind of absolutely are explicit about the assumptions that they're making. And that's what kind of sets a really good archaeologist apart.
Yeah.
Does shipwreck excavation fall under archaeology?
Yeah, underwater excavation is part of archaeology. It's a kind of sub-discipline specialty that you have to go into. Not a huge amount of that going on for most archaeologists, kind of a small subset of archaeologists.
Yeah, probably more like treasure hunters.
Not necessarily. There are, people that are doing underwater excavation of things like Alexandria, which is just it's an inundated coastline in Egypt and things like that. I'm trying to understand the city and how it played out. Yeah, treasure hunters are a different kind of thing. Don't call it archaeology.
I was just wondering, has any legends or anything ever been reliable in finding archaeological sites?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, there's usually legends and oral traditions have a kernel of truth to them, and so you don't ever discount them completely. So it's a matter of taking them and looking for what they are. I think the Heinrich Schliemann approach of taking out a copy of the Odyssey and the Iliad and walking across the landscape was maybe a little bit extreme, but there's always a kernel of truth. And that's chance and luck are very much a part of archaeology.
All right.
Thank you.